Titus Alexander. Titus has written a book, Unraveling Global Apartheid, and it's this theme that his talk will explore a bit more. So I will hand over to him now and leave him to answer the question, is global inequality worse than apartheid was in South Africa? Thank you very much, Titus.
So many of you have come out of one of the few days when we haven't got rain into doors instead of enjoying the sun to talk on this challenging subject. Right. Okay. Is that better? Is that better? Okay. Right. Good. And I believe that. In many respects, the West and Western inequality is worse than apartheid was in South Africa, and the structures are very similar. In 1988, I was very fortunate to visit South Africa at the invitation of some black and Indian friends, and there it hit me very forcibly that here was the first world on top of the third world, inside the borders of the same country. And that was a very forcible experience. And it's the South African tourist board at the time had a slogan, the world in one country. And in many respects, that was much truer than they knew. The book that came out of that was published in 1996, Unraveling Global Apartheid. It virtually disappeared without trace. I think 2,000 copies were sold. And Christian Aid was one of the few journals that actually reviewed it. Which I was very pleased about. But I gave a copy to Tom Bowman-Becky, in fact, a proof copy, and he has since referred to, he's now president of South Africa, and he's referred to global apartheid. But he has got to be very careful about not offending the West, because he relies on investment and grants from the World Bank, one of the institutions of global apartheid, in order to rebuild and reconstruct the country. And other books have since been published on the topic. One of the projects that arose out of that was the campaign in Charter 99, launched in 1999 to the UN Millennium Summit. And there it was quite remarkable how in less than 12 months we managed to get the issue of accountability of global institutions onto the agenda of the UN. And actually Charter 99 was quoted, and I have some copies here if somebody is interested. And so it shows it is possible to do something, and that even if books aren't read. And following from that, there's been the One World Trust Accountability Project, which has been looking at and examining the accountability of institutions. And one of the other issues I've been deeply involved in is climate change and working on education for global issues. These are some of the things that rose out of that experience of visiting South Africa in 1988. And arising, what are the topics I'll cover in the three areas, broadly speaking. What is global apartheid? Looking at the political, economic, and ideological parallels between global inequality and inequality in South Africa, which are very deep indeed. And secondly, look at the dynamics of global apartheid, how it works, and it's basically an interaction between competition and protection and the role of political institutions in that. And thirdly, explore what you can do about it to connect and communicate and make a difference. And so to start with, what is global apartheid? It's a form of government based on global minority rule, systematic discrimination and exclusion of the world's minority, based on national identity rather than on racial categories, although race is still a significant factor in it. But the world's most powerful agent of global apartheid, if you like, the United States, I mean, there is in the Bush cabinet two fairly prominent black people, so they don't explicitly discriminate on race in the way in which South Africa discriminated on. But the actual origins of apartheid in South Africa were based on actually national identity, which is very much what the United States' its power is based on. And the institutions of global government, people often say, well, we ought to have a world government. In fact, we do have a world government, and this is a world government based on over 300 institutions making laws and forcing rules and norms which cover all aspects of our lives. We're largely unconscious of it. Even many of our parliamentarians are not aware of the rules that are made all the time. But post and telecommunications, it's very obvious. Safety at sea. The International Maritime Office is one of the UN institutions. It's the only one based in London. Airfares, for example, you may not know it, but no country is actually allowed to tax aircraft fuel, even although it's a major cause of global warming. That's simply one of the thousands of international rules. And most of these international rules that are made by these institutions are made in our interests. And we are paying through our taxes for officials to negotiate to protect our interests as consumers in the West. And the majority world, sometimes known as the third world or developing countries, but I prefer to call it the majority world, they can often not afford to take part in this rule-making process. They often don't have the capacity to really participate effectively in the global rules. So this system of world government that we are part of is largely invisible, it's highly unequal, and utterly unaccountable to the public, and as I say, it mainly benefits people like ourselves. For example, the UN Security Council, which is one of the potentially most powerful institutions in global government, of the permanent members who have veto powers on any decision in the UN Security Council, 80% of them are white, 60% of them are European. That's how unequal the decision-making is at the top. And so, although it has a mandate to protect security and make in the world, in the whole world, in fact, it's largely role protecting security in the West, a lot of which has been subcontracted, in effect, to the NATO institutions. And so that since the Second World War, when there was this huge commitment to end wars, over 30 million people have died. The UN Security Council stood by while in Rwanda the genocide was taking place. Something like 4 million people have been killed in the Congo and the Great Lakes District in the last 4 years, and we've hardly even seen it on our television screens. So that's a consequence of this structural inequality in decision-making. Then the Bank of International Settlements, you may not have heard of it, but it's a fundamental pillar of global apartheid. It holds, basically manages the world's currency systems, hugely powerful soft law decision-making. It designs the financial architecture of the world. Its main role is to maintain the stability of Western currencies and, as part of that process, depressing the purchasing power of the majority world countries. And at the heart of it is controlled by the decision-making of the world's the so-called G10 group, but in fact that largely consists of the European Central Bank, the American Federal Bank, and within that, of course, the British Central Bank, a very powerful. And what's extraordinary, as part of the Global Accountability Project, we were looking at the institutional mechanisms for accountability in global decision-making institutions. And we said we were going to do them. We wrote to some of the major institutions and said we were going to do this. And the head of the World Bank was so worried by the fact that we were going to do this that he came from Geneva and spent 3 hours with us trying to persuade us why we shouldn't scrutinise them as part of this process. It was also quite remarkable that when we sent our questionnaire and said, this is what we're going to look at, we're going to look at accessibility of information and so forth, within a few days of getting the questionnaire, a remarkable amount of new information about their structures and procedures went onto their website. So it is possible to influence some of these institutions. He tried to persuade us that we shouldn't examine them because I think they were worried that they might have this kind of demonstrations outside them that the World Bank had been seeing. And, of course, they're a lot more powerful than the World Bank and much more invisible. And they were, if you look at them, they're, in fact, much more unaccountable in terms of their structures and procedures than the World Bank or any of the other decision-making institutions, and much more secretive. A lot of the main decisions are made, if you like, at off-balance sheet. They meet for dinner, the central bankers, before the main meeting. They basically agree everything, and they have all their officials to agree it. It's not an official committee of the the Bank of International Settlements. They just service it and provide it the technical support. It's an informal meeting of the central bankers who, in effect, draw up the rules for the world financial system. Then I mentioned the World Bank and the IMF, who are very powerful institutions, but far from the most powerful in the financial system. But they are public institutions, state institutions. And the G7 countries, of which we are part, now called the G8 because Russia has been added on, but it's tokenistic, really. And the G7 have 12% of world population, and between them, over 70% of world investment, control of finance, and over half of the votes in the World Bank and IMF. And so any decisions the World Bank and IMF wants to make that go against the interests of the G7 countries, which includes ourselves, are simply vetoed. And the G7 itself, again, this is not a formal institution. It's an informal meeting every year of the seven most powerful countries agree between them basically how they want to manage the world economy. And this has huge, powerful implications for the rest of the world. One of the other institutions of, as I say, there are over 300 of these world government institutions, is the World Trade Organization, which you probably know about. That, people say, this is much more democratic than the other institutions. It's got one country, one vote. But then countries like the United States and European Union, they can field a team of over 500 officials. So they're making sure that they know what's going on. They coordinate their discussions and strategies. They can really push what they want. And they can have a permanent staff at Geneva, at the headquarters, monitoring all the time. And at least 30 countries can't even afford to have a single official in Geneva following what's going on. So they can't keep up with the decisions. These decisions have very powerful repercussions. The World Trade Organization, again, as you probably know, has powers, very enormous powers, to, in terms of the rules it makes of trade, on how on tariffs and so forth, which can have a huge effect on different industries. And a small decision, some years ago, for example, the United States decided unilaterally that it wanted to put a tariff on textiles, and hundreds of factories in Bangladesh went out of business because they suddenly weren't allowed to sell their prices, their textiles, at a price in the United States market in a way that would cover the costs, because the tariff, the tax that was imposed on it, was going so high. Similarly, you probably know about the argument around bananas, that the European Union has an agreement with some of the smaller countries of the Caribbean to import bananas at a favourable rate so they have a almost living income. It's still far too little, but the United States acted against that and tried to stop that. So it's hugely powerful, and yet when the United States feels that some rules of trade are going against them, what they do is they can get the power to impose tariffs against goods from other countries. But when those countries complain against the United States, there's no power that they can impose, because a tariff to say we're going to ban goods, say if you're Togo or Jamaica wanting to ban goods from the United States, well, it's not going to make any difference to them. And in fact, the World Trade Organization, its structures are deeply hypocritical. It's supposed to be about free trade, but free trade is a complete myth. It's only, for many developing countries, it's forced trade. They don't have much choice. They have to try to get the trade terms that they can do with. And as one trade official for developing countries said to me, from Africa, he said, the one thing that's worse being exploited by a multinational company is not being exploited by a multinational company. In other words, they were the only opportunity that they had to get some foreign revenue and to get and to participate in the world markets. So that for most developing countries, for the past 500 years that we've been engaged with them since Columbus, if you like, the trade has been forced. And yet, from the point of view of the Western countries, a lot of the measures that they exercise of the World Trade through the World Trade Organization are actually measures of protectionism. intellectual property rights, which is one of the big concerns, is a protectionist regulation. And similarly around textiles and agriculture. And I'm sure you will know, and subsidies on those, I'm sure you'll know a lot about that already. But that, what the trade rules do, is act as a filter mechanism which ensure that the added value of production, or the different stages of production, remain with the Western minority and that the work is done as much as possible in the rest of the world. So that raw materials then may have enter into the West tariff free, but if it's turned, for example, cotton is turned into shirts and other things, they will meet an escalating tariff barrier. And in those areas where tariff barriers have been removed, those are areas where the West has allowed that to happen because they've got other ways of getting profit, getting the bigger share from the production. For example, manufacturing used to be largely in the West, and that's where the most added value was done. But since new technologies come in to lower the cost of manufacturing, a lot of it's now gone to the developing countries where it's produced incredibly cheaply, if you think of the price of computers and all these kind of things. So the tariffs on those are low, but the added value is got through the design, the technology, and so forth, which is through the value obtained through intellectual property rights and investment. So the result is this highly unequal world that we live in, and in which we in the West, as I say, the 12% of the world's population consume something like 80% of the world's wealth in money terms. We have an average income in the West over 60 pounds a day. In most of the world, about 80% of the world, it's less than less than 11 pounds away. Half the world is less than about £1.50 a day in purchasing power terms, that's real purchasing terms. And that's what the huge scale of the inequality. Now, in South Africa, when under apartheid, there was great inequality, but nothing of that scale. Another simple statistic of the inequality is that the average life expectancy in the rich world is 78 years. Average life expectancy in the majority world, in the poorest countries, is just over 52 years. And then if you think of the huge infant mortality, something like 30,000 children a day dying from very simple preventable causes. 100 million children have too little to eat, malnourished. Over 100 million, no primary school opportunity to read. Huge differential and huge difference in inequality. And this is a much greater inequality than ever existed between black and white in South Africa. And the West benefits enormously from this huge disparity in terms of the cheap clothes, the cheap food, energy, oil prices now, although they've gone up, they're still cheaper than they were in the mid-1970s, manufacturing goods. And then also, when our economies are booming, as they're doing at the moment, we benefit enormously from migration. And our health service, many of our public services couldn't survive without people coming here from the rest of the world, bringing their skills and abilities. Similarly, a lot of our food in the fields, the majority of the people who pick foods in British agriculture are from overseas. The tragic death of the cockle pickers, although they were illegal in a way, there's a kind of toleration of that illegality, because for them this is an opportunity of a lifetime, risky as it is, coming to a rich world. But for us, it's, you know, we benefit enormously. Similarly, if you look at the tourism trade and catering, the large numbers of people from overseas who come here desperate for work. And in the global system, there is a hierarchy of citizenship, if you like. At the bottom, there are the stateless people and refugees. Then, if you like, the next step up, there are the so-called least developed countries, mainly the African countries. Then there are the countries who are the Western allies, like Saudi Arabia and Indonesia, who have a kind of immunity in international law. Then the OECD countries, which now include Mexico and South Korea and a few other developing countries. And then there's the G8 at the top, and the United States at the very powerful. And although that hierarchy isn't marked with the kind of racial classification as it was in South Africa, the impact and effect is very similar. And there is actually very strong, often, racial correlation if you look at which countries are in which groups. And the United Kingdom is one of the most powerful countries in the world in this international system of global apartheid. We have seats in the permanent five of the UN Security Council. We've got a very significant share in the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, in the Bank of International Settlements, all the most powerful institutions. We are very big players. And Europe as a whole is an enormous block. In fact, it's now a larger block within the international system than the United States. It has a bigger share of votes than the United Nations, has bigger votes in all of the international institutions. But Europe is not using its power to push for justice on the global scale. And so as citizens, we have a huge responsibility. I think we have to use the power that we've got access to help to change the balance of power globally. Because if we don't, we're in a sense colluding with it. And in terms of our long-term survival, I think it's in our interest to do something about it. So just to summarise, you know, what is global apartheid? It is systematic structure of inequality which benefits and supports the West and excludes the majority. It's this huge unequal voting power in the UN Security Council, the World Bank, the Bank of International Settlements. It's the unequal rules of trade that systematically discriminate against goods from the majority world. It's a hierarchy of citizenship and legal protection. It's a global division of labour from which we all benefit every day and constantly. So the second question is, what are the dynamics of it? What's behind the system and how does it work? And really, if you look at it, it's the interaction of three sets of institutions. First of all, finance, which is really the driving force behind global apartheid. Secondly, markets, which create winners and losers through competition. And thirdly, most important of all, are the political institutions who decide who gets protected, who can win, who can lose, and so forth. And of course, in that context, they're supported by beliefs and values of Western superiority, which, in a sense, allow us to tolerate and put up with it. But I think it's very important to understand the dynamics between the interaction of markets and politics. And actually, it's quite interesting to look back to the origins of apartheid in South Africa, because in South Africa, the apartheid grew up in response to the great expansion of the global market at the end of the 19th century and the early part of the last century. And as global competition intensified, increasingly the white workers who'd come from Europe, European workers, were being replaced by black workers because they were cheaper, because they were subsistence workers who lived off the land, as it were, and therefore are not wholly in the money economy, whereas the workers from Europe, on the whole, could only subsist in the money economy. And as they were losing their jobs in the mines and in the fields and replaced by increasingly by black workers, they organised. And you had demonstrations in the 1920s, for example, Workers of the World Unite for a black South Africa, white South Africa. Sorry. Workers of the World Unite for a white South Africa. And they campaigned against global capitalism. And in fact, apartheid was in its origins an anti-capitalist movement of poor white South Africans, mainly of the Afrikaners. And in the early days, in fact, the race conflict was seen at the end of the 19th century as between the Afrikaner farmers and mine workers and the British, who were much wealthier and owned the English origin people who owned the farms. And apartheid was evolved piecemeal in this sort of over a period of 50 years almost, in response to the pressures of global capitalism, creating a white welfare state, a white system of protectionism against the black majority within the country. And it worked. It meant that the poor South Africans, the poor white South Africans, got into an economically strong position, and by the end, when apartheid came to an end, were on the whole very prosperous. So it's this interaction between competition and protection which is at the heart of apartheid. All market developments produce winners and losers. If you invent something that does something better, those who did it the old way lose. And the question is, how do they get protected? And we have all sorts of different forms of protection in our society from the consequences of market forces. If you think about it, limited liability is a form of protection for companies and for the people involved in companies if they go bust. Before you had limited liability, if a company went bust, people would, all the individuals who owned the company would lose everything. Insurance is a form of protection. Health and safety rules, trade rules, consumer protection. We have social security. We have huge forms of protection in our society. In fact, 40% of government spending, in a way, is reallocated, not through the market, but through the state, in order to provide protection for citizens in one way or other, through the public services, through social security. So protection is a natural and inevitable counterpart to competition in a market economy. And the real question is, who gets protection? Who decides on the balance between competition and protection? What are the mechanisms for deciding between competition and protection? And within the West, within Europe now, you have a very extensive system of laws and rules to draw up what kinds of protection we get. So we have agricultural subsidies, which have been introduced for protection. We have all kinds of mechanisms like that. We don't have rules in terms of protection to prevent goods that have been produced by child labour or ensuring that families don't need to rely on child labour in the majority world. We don't have forms of protection that ensure that the goods that we consume are produced by slaves, like, for example, a lot of chocolate is produced. We don't have protection that people who produce goods for us, for our markets in the majority world, they don't get any benefits of the tax that's made put on those goods. The goods that they produce are taxed here, and we get the benefit of the tax. So there's a very powerful system in a way that ensures that we get protected, but the majority world does not. And at the foundation of these rules of protection are, if you like, property rights, which itself is a form of protection. Property right is protects in law the ownership of property. And the way in which property rights are being extended, for example, to intellectual property rights, which I mentioned, and now, for example, in climate change to carbon emissions rights trading. Again, if you look at the ways in which those are structured internationally, the benefits come to us in the West. I'll come back to that. But the driving force behind the market system, behind the competition that's taking place, is from the financial system. In a way, the companies simply respond largely to the financial system. So, in a sense, if one group of consumers have got purchasing power, companies will appear to produce whatever they can persuade them to buy or whatever they want to buy. And as I say, most of the purchasing power, 80% of the world's purchasing power, is in the West. So what we want to buy is what the whole world's production system, in a way, orientates itself around. But behind that is the financial system, which is driving that. And the financial system, I mean, money is very useful. It's very, as a medium of exchange. But we take it for granted, and we don't think of how it comes about. But inherent in money, in the property of compound interest, is that money is increasing exponentially. It means that people who've got money, they expect a return on their money, so that increases exponentially. And an exponential curve is unsustainable. It rises, you know, in a cumulative. And so that puts the constant pressure on companies to cut costs on the one hand and increase production and find new markets and new products and innovate on the other. And so the financial system is the driving force and the controlling force behind the global apartheid. And money is something we, as I say, we take for granted. We don't know really where it comes from, but money is created by banks on the whole. Most of the money in circulation is created by banks who lend it into circulation in the form of loans, and they expect to have the money that comes back. So all the mortgages that we've taken out, you know, we want to go and work to produce more to pay our mortgage. And this keeps the pressure on production. So we're all the time producing more. And because of the protection that's created by the Bank of International Settlements, on the whole, the return on money in the West is much higher than the return on the rest of the world. And so people in the rest of the world who've got spare money, on the whole, instead of investing it locally, they invest it in the West, so that there's this vicious cycle, so that you have this what's known as capital flight, money coming from countries like Mexico and Nigeria. Anything that people earn more than their needs, if they're rich in their country, on the whole, there's less incentive to invest in their own countries than to invest in the Western stock markets and get a greater return. So this financial system acts as a huge sponge and with capillaries right down into the local markets, sucking out the money from the world. And if you want to read more about that, Michael Rowbottom has written two excellent books, Goodbye America and The Grip of Death. So that, very briefly, is the features of the dynamics of global apartheid. The financial system is the driving force, creating and this driving pressure for competition through compound interest and the debt-based system of finance, driving the competitive pressure on companies, creating winners and losers, and then fundamentally the political system, which allocates protection and benefits between the winners and losers and decides which of the losers are going to be protected and which not. I just wanted to, in passing, give a small story of an example of how that works. When the World Trade Organization was being set up, there were huge demonstrations in India of over 1 million farmers protesting against the proposed rules of the World Trade Organization. We didn't hear about it in our press. Nobody paid any attention to it. It might as well have not happened in terms of the effect. There were small demonstrations by farmers in some French cities. They drove into the towns, blocked the traffic and so forth. And for days, there was shuttle diplomacy between the Americans and the Europeans about negotiating the rules, and so that eventually the European Union stepped in and found a way of subsidizing and protecting the interests of those French farmers. The Indians didn't have any of that clout, and they are therefore suffering enormously as a consequence of the increased pressure of competition, whereas the French farmers still receive very substantial subsidies. And that's only one of many examples I can give of the way in which the dynamics work. So that's the dynamics of it. And, of course, it's very important that it's all, in a sense, we don't really know about what's happening. We, with 1% of world population in the United Kingdom, inevitably have a very UK-focused, and we are, in a sense, largely ignorant of what's happening in the rest of the world, in much the similar way than South Africans were ignorant, white South Africans were ignorant to what was happening in their own country. And the media tends to present a sort of us and them picture between us and the rest of the world. And death and suffering of black people, non-white people, is really of much less consequence than the death of one child on the road in Britain. And in terms of our media and our whole environment we live in, the consumer culture that's persuading us to buy, to consume, this idea that if there's a slight dip in the amount that we consume, it's going to be bad for the economy, whereas the amount that we consume is just out of all proportion to our needs. So the consumer culture, the beliefs and values that underpin the system are as an important part of the dynamics. So I want to conclude with some questions about what can we do about it. And it's very important we communicate, we connect, and we campaign. In terms of communication, simply talking about these kind of issues. They're often uncomfortable to raise with people, to raise the questions about global inequality and how we fit into it, to go to workshops to train and understand more deeply about those issues and communicate them. And to connect, to join organisations, to make links with the South in particular. I think the connections between North and South are very important to build solidarity, and to campaign. And there are a huge number of different issues that one can campaign on in global inequality. And I just want to focus on three of what I see as three of the most important areas, which is around climate change, trade, and democratic governance. But I think we shouldn't underestimate the power of what, on the one hand, the power of what we're up against in terms of defending the status quo, or on the other hand, the power and ability that we can have to transform through justice. We just need to be smarter. I mean, I think we're probably looking at something like a 50-year project to transform the world system. Apartheid took 70 years to bring to an end from the beginning of the formation of the African National Congress. It was a very long haul to end the legal and political system of apartheid. The system of global apartheid, in many respects, is even more deeply entrenched than it was in South Africa. And there aren't any allies outside, if you like, to provide global solidarity. So it really is up to us in the West to address the roots of it. And so in terms of, if you like, focusing on, I mean, I think it's very important to recognize that there are many different actions that can make a difference, not just one strategy, in terms of changing the way we purchase things, changing what we do, changing all sorts of different, campaigning on different issues, which I mentioned, and I can go into them. Another one is to recognize that the divisions within the ruling elite, that's fundamentally important. The fact that there are some people among the ruling elite who are willing to talk differently and recognize differently, and within the churches, particularly, for example, which Rowan Williams recently spoke out about climate change. I'll come back to that. And also in finance and business, the fact that there is now ethical investment, there is this concern about being green in business. Often it's greenwash and it's quite superficial, but it's a start and it's something to work with and to push on. And then also an active civil society, organising within communities, making people aware at a local level. It's incredibly important. So just to focus on some of these issues, as I say, climate change. The reason why climate change is such a fundamental key issue at the moment, in a way, I mean, carbon, which is what climate change, the trigger of climate change, is the stuff of life. It's the source of energy. It's the drive. It's one of the major causes of carbon, climate change and global warming is from carbon emissions from fossil fuels. And the consumption of that, of fossil fuels, reflects the huge inequality that we have in the world. The United States, with 5% of world population, uses something like 25%, a quarter of the world's fossil fuels and energy resources. The UK, 1% of world population, just over 2% of global emissions and use of fossil fuels. So double its ecological footprint, if you like. Fossil fuels are a finite resource, and in fact, for good self-interested reasons, we ought to be getting out of fossil fuels, that we've now round about this, during this decade, we will reach the peak of consumption of fossil fuels, and from now on they're generally going to decline, so the price, there'll be pressure on prices, whatever, while demand from the rest of the world is increasing. So there is a self-interest in getting out of fossil fuels. But one of the crucial things in terms of the relation between climate change, it's not just that most of the damage from climate change happens in the majority world, but also that in the carbon emissions trading regime that's being created, we have a new property right that's being formed in which, again, the West will have the majority. Over half of current emissions from fossil fuel burning are in the West, as I say, with 12% of world population. And these, under the Kyoto Protocol, will have a property right which can be traded. And so long as that trade is based on unequal allocations of emissions, in a sense, we are entrenching inequality in this fundamental property right. And in fact, in South Africa, the Land Act of 1913, that was one of the first major steps to entrenching inequality and apartheid. So this property regime, we do need a property regime around carbon emissions. It's a good thing that we have that. And even an emissions trading system is not a bad system. It really depends on what the rules are. And those rules, I argue, need to be based on allocation of equal property rights so that we have a system, and this was the system supported by Rowan Williams in his speech in July, of contraction and convergence to equal per capita emissions globally. It sounds very complicated, but it very means simply that this finite resource of carbon emissions should be equally allocated equally, and if we use more of it, as we do in our country, in this country, then you have to buy permits from people who use less. And that would reward people for using less and having less impact on the global environment, and it would create a virtuous cycle. So this system of contraction and convergence of property rights in carbon emissions potentially is very powerful. And there's a campaign, which I've got some information on, about a global climate community. We're not likely to see the United States want to join something like that, but countries of Europe and developing countries could form an alliance, just like the six countries of the formed alliance around the European Community and now expanded to 25. Instead of creating a fortress Europe, we could join up with countries in the poorest countries of the world and say, look, we're going to form a global alliance of some countries based on contraction and convergence to equal capita rights, and we're going to share the benefits. So that just like within the European Union, there's redistribution between rich countries and poor countries, so from countries like Germany and Britain to Portugal and Ireland, which has benefited enormously, we can have a similar system at a global scale within the context of tackling with climate change, which is the most serious issue we face as a species. The second area is trade, the trade rules. And here, Christian Aid is taking a lead in terms of the trade justice campaign. And that is a fundamentally important one. And it's a very difficult one because it is challenging people very powerfully in terms of saying we want fair rules and we're willing to risk the consequences in terms of unemployment, and we're going to have to work how we create a fair and just system of protection in response to something like that. And the third area is a bit more obscure that I mentioned, but it's to do with transparency and decision-making in global governance. Some people say, like George Monbiot, he advocates having a world parliament and having that to be a more just system. I'm in favour of world parliament, but I think it would be extremely dangerous if we had one now, because what would happen? It would be something like the US Congress or even in India, when essentially those who've got money and power effectively buy their candidates. The poor majority of the world won't really have a say in a proper, in a world parliament in the system as it is now. You would have rich countries offering poor constituents, we'll build a health centre for you or a road for you here if you vote for us. And I think that wouldn't be a change. But what would make a change in the global system if we had transparency and accountability mechanisms in global decision-making so that we can see who's making what decisions where, what decisions are coming up, and campaigning on them. So that, for example, the World Trade Organization, which is a very secretive organization, at the last meeting in Cancun, there was a very vigorous campaigning with the Trade Justice Campaign, and the G20 group of majority world countries got together and they managed to prevent what they saw as an unfair agreement. And the more transparency you have in this decision-making system. Similarly, if people knew what decisions and how the decisions were made in the Bank of International Settlements, they wouldn't accept it. Institutions like the International Criminal Court, again, to enforce the rule of law internationally. We're beginning to see some of the effects of it with people like Pinochet at the end of his life, having to face up to the consequences of his coup in Chile in 1973 and the murderous actions there. These are tiny straws in the wind, but they're part of the process of building a more accountable and transparent system of global governance. And above all, in terms of bringing about change, we need to tell a new story about our place in the world. At the moment, we have a very powerful but limiting story about fighting for survival in a hostile world. And we have to replace that with a story about neighbours in an interdependent world, resolving problems through cooperation and mutual respect and having fair rules and creating a just floor in terms of what kind of standards of living we won't accept people to fall under. After the Second World War, there was a huge vision for that, in fact. If you look at some of the principles in the United Nations Charter and in terms of the Charter even of the World Bank and the IMF, it was about creating jobs and that. But basically, the West wasn't willing to have real power distributed and to make that possible. So we still operate very much internationally on this principle, this myth, this story about this is a dangerous world struggling for survival, we must fight our corner. And instead of seeing each other as neighbours, seeing each other as competitors. And over the next 50 years, the world's population is likely to increase by 50%, so that instead of having 6 billion people in the world, which is already crowded, there'll be possibly around 9 billion people. We already, as a species, consume over 30% of the world's biomass in terms of the living matter that's produced. There's a huge competition for resources with other species and also between different groups of human beings. And this is going to get much more intense over water, food, energy, as I say, with oil as it's peaked. No country can go it alone. We've got to work together. We've got a choice. And if you think back at the beginning of the last century, there was also a choice. And at that time, the last century, in a sense, we chose war twice, the First World War and the Second World War. In a way, each of those war, the problems that led up to those war, were similar to the kind of problems that are leading up to the moving into the century, this 21st century. And there's a real danger so far in terms of the major decision makers of the world. We have chosen war and conflict. And we've seen the consequences of that in Iraq. And we saw the consequences of that in Rwanda. We're seeing the consequences of that in the Congo, where the ongoing killing continues and the deaths. We really have to turn round the way that we see this century and see that unless we act together, we will, in a sense, destroy the planet together, because we have no other planets to go to. If the rest of the world is going to enjoy the kind of levels of consumption that we have in this country, we will need several more planets, and they're simply not available. So that if we are going to live in this world together as a species, we've got to find rules that are fair and just and equal. And each of us and all of us can play a part in that. Thank you. And if there's time, I'd be very glad to... We've got about 10 minutes to answer questions, to give any points. And I know that someone from Christian Aid wants to say something about contributing to their work on this. Yeah. Not enough. And in fact, it's got worse. There used to be, for example, International Broadcasting Trust was producing television programmes on the majority world. And it closed, I think, or wound down about 2 years ago. It's done annual surveys of the representation in the media. And what can be done is to write to the media and say, you want to see more things in the press and in television, particularly television, telling us the truth about what's going on. And it's But even our intellectual press, like the Guardian, I mean, I think it's shameful. The Guardian, I think, is twinned with the Mail in South Africa. And yet the representation on the whole, although there are some good things on there, if you look at the consumer pages, the encouragement to buy and all of the rest in a paper like The Guardian, it's as much a collusion as the rest of the media. So, yeah.
If we have a system of trading carbon emissions,
yes,
and a country like America buys the allocation of Rwanda, say, wholesale,
yeah,
what effect does that have on the selling countries? They've got a little bit of foreign exchange now for the Americans. What effect does that have on their ability to develop their own economy?
I think it's incredibly important that a trading system is managed. In other words, that the question was, what would the effect be of trading, if the Americans, for example, bought the carbon allocation from a country like Rwanda, for example? I'm saying it really depends on the rules and the framework under which that trade takes place. There is a real danger that what might happen is, as it happens at the moment with the trade in oil. For example, a country like Nigeria or Guinea, which has suddenly discovered oil, instead of benefiting the country, that oil is being used to buy wealth for a tiny minority. So it's very important that the trading system happens within a system of rules that's transparent and allows them to invest. But if you look at, for example, differences between countries like Ghana and Singapore in the 60s had similar standards of living. Singapore and Ghana have chosen different rules to govern the way they work, and Singapore is, relatively speaking, prosperous. It's a Western country to all intents and purposes, and Ghana isn't. Similarly, Ghana and Botswana, Sierra Leone and Botswana. Sierra Leone and Botswana both have diamonds. Botswana has used their income in a much more better way, and it depends on having rules of transparency, rules against corruption, and internationally enforceable laws. And I also think that it should have, one should always have a sense of purpose of what is the trade for. That the trade is not just for how to get rich quick, but it's for the mutual benefit of everybody involved. And I think to a certain extent the social market principles of the European Union have that concept of having a floor of standards of living rather than the United States model of trade, where, as we know, there are a huge proportion, over 30 million Americans, live in terrible poverty. So it does depend on the framework within which the trade takes place.
Question over here.
Yeah.
How on earth can you get a system of trading carbon emissions if the United States aren't prepared to even enter into the system?
Well, I'd say two things. First of all, I think the question was, how on earth are you going to get a system of trading carbon emissions if the US won't enter into it? Within the US, there will be companies who want to take part. There are companies who are being and there are sectors of the economy in the US who are suffering from climate change. And it's really interesting, even this week, the US government published a report that accepted not only that climate change is existing, which is what George Bush denied shortly after coming to office, but that it's being caused by consumption of fossil fuels. Many American states are already looking at ways of curbing carbon emissions because it's affecting agriculture, it affects sections of tourism. There are also interests in terms of green fuel technologies who would benefit from a move to a new market. And also there's the fundamental issue of security. Increasingly, the world's oil reserves are in dangerous and insecure places like Saudi Arabia. And it'll be in their self-interest to be part of a global system to deal with it. It may not happen in 10 or 20 years. That's why there's parallel between the European Union, where a group of countries, north and south, get together and saying, look, we're going to go ahead with a fair and equitable and just system of dealing with climate change based on equal per capita allocations. The United States will rush to join it, just like the Britain, several decades after, a decade after the European Union was formed, desperately try to get in. I think the United States will desperately try to get in. There were many different... I think that's a very important point. There were a number of different factors. One factor was that they had short loans that were running out. Sorry. To a certain extent, yes. Those forces, that's why I say, do not underestimate it, the forces of injustice. But on the other hand, it's like the transformation from the 19th century Britain to a welfare state Britain, in which, you know, in the 19th century, less than 10% or something like 10% of the country's wealth was redistributed through the state in the form of social protection. Now it's about 40%. And we have social security, unemployment, all sorts of measures to prevent absolute poverty, people from being driven into slavery. Slavery is technically illegal. We have a political process that all the time people are arguing for protection for this, against this or that injustice. And similarly, that's the potential at a global scale, that we'll have a political system to counteract the tendency towards injustice. It doesn't mean there isn't a foolproof way of preventing it. I mean, South Africa is, there's a lot of inequality there still, as you rightly say. A lot of white people still had control most of the power. But there has also been a dramatic shift for the majority, or for a significant part of the majority. Any other?
I think we've just got time for one more. This gentleman.
When it comes down to it,
no.
I work for a large computer company. A large amount of the work the people in my company are doing is now being outsourced to India. I may be in danger of losing my job. Now, the fact that people in India have got the work is great, and I support that, but I would find it very hard to argue among my colleagues at the office that that was a good thing. They're in danger of losing their jobs. You see the...
Absolutely, and I mentioned that in passing. This is going to be a very big challenge. I think we really fundamentally, and it really touches at the heart of this, we need to get a redefinition of wealth. A lot of the work that we're doing is actually unnecessary, being driven by finance to pay mortgages, to increase asset values, in other words, making property, pictures, all sorts of things like that more expensive, which isn't necessary. We're doing a lot of unnecessary work. If we saw wealth in terms of time, and if we were able to redistribute time and work fairly so that we can have a real quality of life, if we also adjusted our consumption patterns in terms of over-consuming the world's resources so that the rest of the world can have enough, then we will all be better off. We will be safer. We will need to spend less on security. And there are all sorts of other benefits. But this is a very deep question. And I think there's a workshop at 3:00, which is basically a discussion opportunity to take forward some of these things in the Christian Aid tent. And I'd be very glad to continue the discussion about how we address these issues and what we can do about it then. So, thank you.
Christian Aid was really delighted when Titus Alexander accepted our invitation to come along and speak at Greenbelt. And as he said, Christian Aid is very much engaged in the fight against global apartheid. We would really like to invest more money in the campaigning work that we're doing on that, and that's why we gave you all a leaflet called Giving to Christian Aid when you came in. We're that subtle. as well as campaigning on that kind of a level, we of course are also working very much with the victims of global apartheid by supporting about 500 local community groups in about 50 countries of the world that are fighting poverty where it is and however it's manifesting itself. And again, we really need to put more money into those projects. We've got a team of fundraisers at Greenbelt, and what we're really looking for are people who would like to help out by giving a small amount to Christian Aid month by month. That kind of support really is the most valuable, and it helps us to be the best stewards of what you're giving to us, because it means that we can plan strategically for the future, knowing what our income will be, and the community groups that we give the money to can do the same. We can guarantee to them that we will be able to give them a sum of money for the next so many years. I know that lots of you in this room do that already, so thank you very much. And I hope to be able to get to the bottom of the stairs before the rest of you do, to speak there to anybody who's interested in giving to Christian Aid in this way. Thanks very much.
If you want some information on any of the points I've mentioned, I've got some leaflets here.
Thank you very much. Would like you to sort of clear the venue. Just on a personal note, if anybody sees a pair of blue-lensed Oakleys with silver frames, they're mine. Thank you.